From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
El Cerrito,
Union Square,
San Francisco,
South of Market,
from Albany,
Hayes Valley,
Rock Ridge, in Oakland.
I'm from the Civic Center. I live across the street.
Coming up, a survey of Mission District residents gives insight into academic achievement gaps.
30% of them don't graduate from college. They drop out after the second year.
Then, we dive into the watery past of a Bay Area town.
Many millions of years ago, Orinda used to be under a shallow sea, and where they might be sitting might be where sea elephants swam by.
And we'll talk to the director of a new documentary about Star Trek and social media star George Takei.
He's like the most accepted outsider ever.
We boldly go where no man or woman has gone before. Today on Cross Currents. Today's the first day of school in San Francisco. Across the city, families packed lunches and brought kids back to the classroom with hopes for a good year. But according to Carolina Guzman with the nonprofit Mission Economic Development Agency, or MEDA, many children in the Mission District face academic struggles.
We have some of the lowest performing academic schools, academic achievement in the county. We also have very high truancy, very high, you know, dropout rates throughout our high schools.
Why are schools in the Mission so far behind? Guzman and Mehta believe some answers may lie not in the classroom, but in the community. That's why they're getting families to open up about life in the Mission by going door to door. KALW's Melanie Young has the story.
At the Mission Economic Development Agency, or MEDA, logistics coordinator Sophia McGurk is handing out backpacks filled with surveys, maps, and pens. She's sending teams of staff and volunteers on a quest for answers.
Amelia, coming to the front.
So here's your surveys and here's your... And you guys have enough postcards in the front pockets?
McGurk pairs Amelia Martinez, who works at MEDA, with Elizabeth Montiel, a volunteer. With their survey forms, a list of addresses, and GPS in hand, they head out the door with high hopes.
All right, so we're going to be in the area of like 23, 24th Van Ness area.
But the morning is full of challenges. From homes vacated and on the market...
It looks like it could be that empty building.
It's the building for sale. It's empty.
To doorways without doorbells.
It is so weird that buildings don't have doorbells. How can that be? How do you get in?
So the women leave postcards inviting those they missed to take the survey at MEDA. Mission resident Rosie Bustamante accepted the invite.
Let's get started. How long have you lived in this area?
In the Mission, I've lived, 13 years.
She's asked about raising her family, whether she's helped out at school this year.
No, but I really want to.
How much exercise her children get.
He does have capoeira twice a week, and he does soccer twice a week.
Whether she worries about housing costs and having to move.
Strongly agree.
If they use neighborhood-based services.
I've needed math classes in the last year for my youngest son. So maybe change that to yes.
What she likes about the Mission.
It's full of Latinos, like me. And then I think the other one is there's a lot of activities.
Between April and June, over 450 households completed the 57-page survey. Now MEDA is crunching the numbers. Guzman says their preliminary findings already show the connection between what's happening in the neighborhood and how kids do in school.
Families are spending 60 to 70% of their salaries and housing. We're finding that there's a lot of overcrowding. And that has true impact on children's ability to do homework, to engage in school, you know, because they don't have a space to study. You know, it's always noisy. It's always something happening. They may not sleep well. They may not eat well.
And, says Guzman, student performance has neighborhood groups and parents worried and looking for a way out.
Our Head Starts in the Mission, their job is to make sure kids who are in their Head Start are getting ready to enter kindergarten, ready to learn. What we're finding is that a lot of our Head Starts are encouraging parents to apply for schools outside of the Mission because they don't think that the schools in the Mission are going to help the kids succeed.
Guzman is optimistic, though. The Mission is a U.S. Department of Education promise neighborhood. That means the federal government is helping fund both the survey project and programs to support students from cradle to college. Feedback from the surveys will help guide how the city, schools, and community organizations serve the neighborhood.
What we want is for programs like Head Start to say, you know what, we trust our elementary schools and we know that they will be great for your kids. That doesn't just happen over one day. It doesn't just happen by hearsay, right? We need to create the evidence as to why those schools are now the right schools for these families.
MEDA will present its initial findings in October. They'll conduct two more surveys over the next 3 years with a goal of making sure services and the people who need them match up. In San Francisco, I'm Melanie Young for Cross Currents. How do you see income inequality affecting education where you live? What do you think we can do to bridge the gap in the schools? Let us know your thoughts at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll try to feature your comment on the air. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane. Many Bay Area place names have Spanish origins. Look no further than the Mission District we just heard about. But some names in this area predate the arrival of Europeans. There's Coloma in the Gold Country, Petaluma in Sonoma, and Olima in Marin County. Those names come from our region's native people. An East Bay town with a similar word construction, Orinda, would appear to also derive from a native term. But that's far from true. Far, far from true. As we'll find out in this installment of The Source. Here's KALW's Stephen Short with that story.
Meet Kay Norman.
I'm Kay Norman, and I'm a past president of the Orinda Historical Society.
She's still involved with the society in various capacities.
But mostly work with third graders and take them on Orinda history tours.
Present-day Orinda wasn't established until the 1920s, but students on her tours learn about local events much older than that.
They're fascinated by such things as the fact that many millions of years ago, Orinda used to be under a shallow sea, and where they might be sitting might be where sea elephants swam by, and they, of course, they love things like that.
Sea elephants? Well, who doesn't? But if you want to know the difference between a sea elephant and an elephant seal, you'll have to stop by the Historical Society to hear that whole story. This story is going to skip ahead a few millennia to the early 1800s, when one John Marsh of Massachusetts arrived in California. Marsh is known as the first non-Hispanic white settler to live in what is now Contra Costa County, and he's thought to be the first person to practice Western medicine in California. He profited handsomely from his doctoring, and Kay Norman says,
he owned vast tracts of land.
Move forward a bit in time, and the rich doctor now has a daughter, sort of like that scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
She's beautiful, she's rich, she's got huge tracts of land.
And that daughter, named Alice, along with her huge tracts of land, caught the attention of William Cameron,
who was also a landowner in this area.
Young Alice was interested in young William, and they wed. But this is a story about Orinda. Remember Orinda? Well, Alice certainly did. And here's the connection. The new Mrs. Alice Marsh Cameron
was very interested in a 17th century English poetess named Catherine Fowler Phillips.
Phillips, the English poetess, formed a group called the Society of Friendship, inspired by a French idea that arrived in England in the 1630s.
And this was a group of people that got together and they talked about the classics, and they were very interested in the ideal woman writer, and they were very interested in friendship and what it meant to people, especially women's friendship to other women.
Now, the Society of Friendship wasn't a secret society, but there was some role-playing. Each member chose a poetic persona for the group, you know, like an avatar. Want to guess the name Catherine Fowler Phillips chose? Oh, go ahead. Guess.
As a matter of fact, Catherine Fowler Phillips chose the pseudonym of the Matchless Orinda.
The Matchless Orinda. Alice Marsh Cameron liked the name so much that when it was time to name her property in Contra Costa County, she called it Orinda Park.
So now we have not only one Orinda that we don't know where it comes from, the one in California, but we have this other one from England that we still aren't sure where it comes from.
That's correct.
It is known, however, that Alice Marsh Cameron owned a book of poetry by the Matchless Orinda. It's now in the collection of the Bancroft Library in Berkeley. But this English poetess didn't create the word Orinda. Where did she get it?
The first rumor I heard was that it was an Egyptian breadfruit.
Well, I'm wondering if it might be some kind of a term of endearment. You know, in French they say, my little cabbage, mon petit chou, as an endearment. Maybe my little breadfruit might have been something.
Well, if anybody called me an old breadfruit, I don't think I would like it. But another idea was, if you look it up on Google, for instance, it says that the name is pronounced Orinda, like we do, but they say it's of Latin origin and possibly related to the Spanish word oro, meaning gold. Or it might be a variant of the Spanish word linda, meaning pretty.
There might be some validity to that. The town is located on land that was part of Spanish ranchos, and relics from the conquistadors have been unearthed in backyards. Some of those artifacts are on display at the Historical Society Museum. But Catherine Fowler Phillips, the Matchless Orinda, would not have known any of this. So here's another clue. A History of Orinda was published in 1976. Edward de la Viaga, who developed much of the current town, including the golf course and country club, is quoted as remembering his family saying that the Camerons, you remember the Camerons with the huge tracts of land? The Camerons had taken the name from a book. But de la Viaga was a boy at the time, so this testimony would not be admissible in court, and perhaps not in this story either. Now, remember those sea elephants from millions of years in the past? The ones that swam where Orinda is today? Well, there's another Orinda connection worth mentioning, something those third graders won't hear on their tours. This is also from long, long ago, and far, far away. And we can most certainly eliminate this one. In the Star Wars saga, Orinda was a small mid-rim planet in the Arishi sector. It eventually became the capital of the Empire, but that's a different story entirely. And while that eliminates yet another possible source, it still doesn't get us to a solid answer. But think about it. Maybe that ambiguity is exactly the right answer for a place probably inspired by a poetess. In the Matchless Orinda, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
To hear more stories that dig into the history of the Bay Area, go to KALW.org and search for The Source. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane. We just heard how Orinda lent its name to a planet in the movie Star Wars. Now, on to another pop culture franchise about space, Star Trek. Local filmmaker Jennifer Kroot has always been a fan, in particular of the character Sulu, played by George Takei.
I had warp one, Mr. Sulu.
Accelerating to warp one, sir.
4.7.
Takei was one of the first stars to portray Asian Americans in a positive light on the small screen. But he's been a role model in other ways, too. In 2005, at the age of 68, he came out as gay and became a fierce advocate for marriage equality. He's also spoken out against the kind of hatred that landed him and his family in a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II. He's renewed his fame as a Facebook phenomenon with 7 million followers. In her new film, To Be Takei, Jennifer Crute takes a close look at Takei's life, from recent activism to his internment as a child. Crute spoke with KALW's Hanat Bava.
At first, they were kept actually in horse stalls in Santa Anita racetrack. And his parents were very upset about that. But to him and his siblings, that was really fun, because that's where horses lived, even though there were no horses there right then. And then they were taken from Los Angeles, where he was born, to Roar, Arkansas, which is the farthest east of all of the internment camps. And it was before they went to Roar that his dad explained this was a vacation, this long vacation to Arkansas. And George was excited. He thought this was an exotic sounding place, and he had no reason to not believe that it was. And on the train, there were armed guards, you know, and he just assumed that that's how people went on vacations. And then coming home was when he really faced some more discrimination because of the anti-Japanese sentiment from the war, and then was also anti-Japanese American sentiment. And he had teachers calling him Jap boy and refusing to call on him, and, you know, being treated like the enemy, even though he's an American citizen born in Los Angeles and just trying to grow up there.
And he remembers all of this.
Yes. Yeah. No, he seems to have a very vivid memory for this experience.
Takei plays this charming character in your film. But there are a couple of scenes with some former cast members from Star Trek. And in one scene, he tells a former cast member that, you know, he looks fat. And later his husband is telling him, you know, he's lecturing him, saying, you know, that was an insensitive comment. So let's take a listen to that clip.
Well, how are you?
How are you?
How's it going?
Just great.
No, I'm so good to see you.
You have gained weight. You need to work on that.
Well, that's great. You know, work out a little
hungry.
Bit.
George, you know, you really embarrassed Will. You're not doing good Will when you do that sort of thing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're not sorry.
I mean, I love that. It's sort of a romantic comedy. I mean, I don't think too many documentaries are a romantic comedy. And it, you know, just shows the normalcy of these two men, you know, two husbands who've been together for so long, and just how that's the same as anyone's marriage, you know, probably as anyone's good marriage.
So let's talk about the 2008 wedding mm-hmm. and the marriage. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if he felt that he still had the support of all the Star Trek kind of fans and followers, or was there, you know, were there questions about his marriage?
Because he was gay, just...
Yeah.
Star Trek fans are a pretty progressive bunch, generally. I think they're for civil rights and things like that, important things like that. So I don't think George has ever mentioned getting any... you know, backlash from Star Trek fans. I mean, I can't, you know, there's probably millions of Star Trek fans in the world, so maybe there's some, but I think...
But there wasn't a backlash.
No, really, not at all. So, and I think George has used his Star Trek fame to leverage the ability to be able to talk about civil rights. You know, before he was out for Asian Americans, for African Americans, and he's always been just a huge civil rights advocate. And you have to remember... It wasn't that easy to come out at that time, especially, I think, as a man in Hollywood. I still don't think it's that easy. He was really expecting his career to be over, but, you know, suddenly became a voice on many, many news shows to talk about civil rights for LGBT people.
A Star Trek star's stunning secret.
I started noticing boys, and they were more interesting to me than girls.
Sulu comes out of the closet.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Bhabha. I'm speaking with Jennifer Crute, director of the documentary To Be Takei, about the life of George Takei. All right, before I let you go, I have to ask you about Takei's Facebook feed, mm-hmm. which is pretty popular.
Yes, it's even been called by Wired magazine that, or it's even been said that George is the most important person on Facebook. It started as a way to publicize his involvement in the musical Allegiance and just to get a presence in social media. And then he just really got into it. And as it went on, you know, I remember I was one of the first, because I have him on Google Alert, and so I saw it, and I was like maybe one of the first less than 100 fans. And then I just remember how fast it grew, and I was like, oh, my God. I have a lot of young people say, oh, George Takei, he's that comedian on Facebook. So they don't even know, you know, that he's actually a Star Trek icon.
What do you want people to know about George Takei through your film? If there was, like, one takeaway, what would that be?
You know, I think it's important to keep the memory of the internment alive, and then just to show how someone who experienced that can go on and stay relentlessly positive, really, and succeed through their life. And now as an older person, just continue really living their life to its fullest and doing really positive things. I think not that many people do that, so it's hopeful for all of us. He's like the most accepted outsider ever.
That's filmmaker Jennifer Crute. Her documentary, To Be Takei, opens in theaters this Friday. For more information, go to kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Julie Kane. And now it's time for the book report, brought to you by the Litography Project.
The Litography Project, your literary guide to San Francisco.
For the book report, we ask Bay Area writers to tell us about a book that's meaningful for them. Today, we hear from Catherine Ma, a writer and lawyer living in San Francisco.
I'm going to talk about American Pastoral, which is a novel by Philip Roth. It's a story of a multi-generational immigrant family. The main character, he's called the Swede. He's a Jewish kid from Newark, New Jersey, who lives a charmed life. He grows up a star in his local high school. He marries a beautiful woman. He has a very successful business that he's inherited from his father. And then things go badly wrong when his daughter commits an act of domestic terrorism. So it's a book about the American dream and the destruction of the American dream. Roth looks brilliantly at a number of themes that I'm really interested in. The immigrant story, the multi-generational family story, identity, and the notion of America as a kind of mythology that we must try to understand and come to grips with. Part of the reason I think the book is so interesting to me is because Philip Roth is showing us these are enduring issues for authors to examine. These are not passé topics. These are things that are deeply human. And as long as we are thinking and reading, we will want to think about what family means and what American culture and American politics have to tell us decade after decade. So the idea that he made it very fresh is very exciting to me. The book is filled with references to music, to the kind of music I would imagine that Philip Roth listened to when he was growing up.
Again, the musical scene is the Monte Carlo.
The post-war, liberating, wonderful music. And he has in the book the words from that marvelous Johnny Mercer tune.
The song that expresses the hope in millions of hearts tonight. Dream.
Dream when the day is through. Dream and they might come true. Things never are as bad as they seem. So dream, dream, dream.
Dream when you're feeling blue.
Roth is telling us right away, right at the very beginning of the book, that this book is going to be about dreams. But we all know what happens to dreams, you know. Dreams usually die.
Just
watch the smoke rings rise in the air.
Writer Catherine Ma just published her first novel, The Year She Left Us. You can find it now at your local bookstore. Today's book report was produced by Nina Gensler-Debs for the Litography Project. To learn more, go to kalw.org. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Jenny Butler, Lisa Carmack, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daniel Moore, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, and Liza Veal. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Our line producer is Sandhya Dirks. Our senior producers are Jen Chien and me, Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And because of your support, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. Well, you made it through Monday. If you're looking for something to help you get through the rest of the week, you might try the band French Cassettes, who you're hearing now. You can catch the summery sounds of French Cassettes live on Thursday at the Chapel in San Francisco. Music starts at 9 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.
Can't make it up this time.